Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Small Town Crafter 3, The Initiate Artificer, by Tom Watts, narrated by Dan Kelly. Chapter 1. One morning I was in the workshop working on a pair of telepathic notebooks. The idea was that writing in one notebook could make the words appear in the other, allowing communication across wide spaces. Only the wide spaces part was proving tricky. Oh, and the part where writing on one notebook made words form on the other. So, pretty much the whole thing. I wasn't ready to give up, though. Ever since I had earned the initiate rank in artificery, Master Cooper had been sharing some of our more complex customer requests with me. This was what I'd always wanted, and it was through working on projects like these that I would earn the next rank in my profession, adept. I was determined to finish the notebooks without asking for help. If I asked Cooper too many questions, he might think I wasn't ready for the tougher projects yet, that I couldn't handle the work that would really build my artificeric muscles. I needed to do this alone. Now, if only I could have a second to work in peace. An artificery workshop is a busy and dangerous place at the best of times. What with all the sharp saws, complex machinery, and the crystallized form of mana that we artificers use, which must be kept in a specially made weatherproofed storage shed. And the smells. The aromas in my workshop would wrinkle your nose one way and then wrinkle it the other. And the air always vibrates with the rhythmic tink-tink-tink of artificers' hammers and the rough bite of a hacksaw going back and forth. I wouldn't recommend visiting me at work if you were looking for peace and quiet. Had a dozen huge wolfhounds, a cantankerous old man, a town crier with a never-ending appetite, and an initiate artificer, and you had the recipe for a hectic work environment. Not only did we have all of that going on, but Artificery Master Jack Cooper and Alchemy Master Janie Morgan had recently married. Janie, though she didn't mind being referred to as Mrs. Cooper or Mrs. Cooper Morgan, had legally retained her own surname. This was fair enough, given that she had surrendered the lease on her home and shop in Brunswick, loaded all her clothes, alchemy equipment, and jars of chemicals onto a cart, and travelled across Easterly to live here in the Craftstead. Having an extra person living with us sure made a difference. Things were hectic, no doubt about it. But then, as if to make it even harder for me to concentrate, Cooper had made a deal with someone whose sole purpose in life seemed to be to make my working days difficult. A knock at the door heralded the appearance of Phil Brownhill, who used to work as the head of house in Jace Porter's Manor and had recently quit to start a business building model ships. I was still getting accustomed to seeing him wearing casual clothes. His baggy patterned shirt with sleeves rolled up just didn't look right on him, nor did the week's worth of grey-brown beard on his face. I was used to seeing him open the door of Jace Porter's Manor replete in his smartly pressed, well-fitted black-and-white formal suit, along with his impeccably groomed face and hair. The man standing in my doorway that morning looked like Philip's wild younger brother. Seeing him, I felt little prickles of irritation up and down my arms, like I was being bitten by ants. I've always had a long fuse, but ever since Phil had started working here in the Craftstead, I found myself having to take more deep breaths than usual. It wasn't that I didn't like Phil, it was just that I found everything he ever said or did annoying. Even so, I was determined not to show it. Phil was paying Cooper so he could work here in the Craftstead, and he had as much right to be here as me. No matter how he behaved, I would make him feel welcome here in the workshop. "I told you, Phil," I said, "you don't need to knock every time before you come in. This is your workshop as well as ours while you're renting space in it." Hearing me use his name, Phil smiled. Until recently, he had been known throughout Sunhampton as Philip. As part of his resignation from his lifelong position as head of house of a manor, he'd also insisted that folks used this shortened version of his name. I guessed that to him, Philip and Phil were separate people. Philip wore a smartly pressed suit and addressed everyone as Sir. Phil wore cologne, fashionable stubble and rumpled shirts. "Sorry, Louis," he said, stepping through the doorway and swinging a crafter's satchel from his shoulder. "Manners are like chickweeds. I can pull one, sure, but give it a week and it grows back."
"What did we say about Louis?"
He snapped his fingers and pointed at me.
"Right, you hate it."
"You need to relax with the door knocking and that kind of thing. Stop having your lunch at exactly the same time every day. Things don't work like that here in the Craftstead. Enjoy your freedom." Phil started unpacking his array of metal files, planes, chisels, wood glue, stacks of bamboo strips, and a half-built ship onto his workbench, occasionally glancing back at me.
The man was hardly a prison, let's be honest. I used to eat pomegranate for breakfast, and I slept on a goose feather bed. I spent my whole working life under a set of rules, Lewis. Not using any when I work here feels strange. It's like I'm trying to scrub out a tattoo. Perhaps I ought to actually get a tattoo.
That's something old Philip would never have done. I guess it'll take some getting used to, but you'll learn to enjoy it, I said.
That remains to be seen. Rules keep fun organized and safe. A rule a day keeps chaos at bay.
He leaned over his workbench, as if to whisper to me, even though he was all the way across the room.
I made that saying up.
It's very catchy, I said. Phil headed over to the counter in the far corner of the room and pressed the button on the copper kettle to lift up the flap. Seeing that there was no water in it, he held it aloft.
What did we say about the kettle, Lewis?
My early resolve to be patient with Phil broke suddenly and disastrously. Weeks of internal frustration suddenly came to the fore, like I was a wasp nest, and Phil was unwisely poking me with a long stick while wearing a shirt with "Please sting me" written on it. Struggling to keep my temper in check, I replied, "I think we said, leave me alone and let me get on with my work." Phil wagged his finger.
Now, Lewis, I know this has always been your workshop, and I know I can be irritating sometimes, but there's no need to get testy. Structure is what keeps civilization going, you know. There's a wider structure in society, and this breaks into smaller patterns of structure in towns, organizations, and right here in the workshop. Follow my rules, and we'll both be better workers.
I was a student of the if you don't have anything nice to say, then don't say anything school, but having Phil around was like hearing the end-of-term bell ring. His rules irked me to the point that I had considered telling Master Cooper I simply couldn't work in the same workshop as him. Half of me suspected that Cooper knew this already and was enjoying the fact that I was getting annoyed. That would be exactly the kind of thing he'd find amusing.
I'll fill the kettle this time, he said, but remember the rule. The last person to empty it should be the one who fills it up again.
As I watched Phil leave the workshop and head out into the yard and toward the water pump, I took a moment to remind myself of my earlier pact not to get worked up. It wasn't that Phil was a bad person. Heck, I'd always liked the guy. Not majorly so, more in the way I liked strawberry jam. It was good to spread on toast from time to time, but I wouldn't want to eat it every day. That was the problem, I supposed. Ever since Philip had started his model ship crafting business and had rented workshop space here at the Craftstead, it was like I was being forced to eat jam with every meal. Jam sandwiches, jam pies, even jam with my steak and potatoes. He's a good person, and he means well. Besides, he's a fellow crafter trying to build up his business, and Cooper's workshop is the only place he can afford. I should be nicer to him. I will be nicer to him. Bolstered by my resolve and by my re-emergence of the more positive part of my personality, I felt better. Everyone has a side of themselves that they don't quite like, I supposed. The bitter part, the mean part, the part that secretly hoped their neighbour's fancy new cart was struck by lightning, or the part that got so annoyed by a co-worker's incessant yammering that they silently wished a mild form of plague on them. Not a nasty kind, just a little pox that would keep them away from work for a day or two. I had that side to me just like anyone else, but today was a good day because I had defeated mine. I even managed to smile at Phil when he returned from the yard holding a now full copper kettle that he had filled up using the outdoor pump. Setting this on an artificed glowstone to heat up, he opened a small pantry door and took out a mug.
"Cup of tea or coffee?"
he asked.
"Yes, please," I answered.
"Well, which one?"
"Coffee."
"One cup of hazelnut roast coming your way,"
he said, before taking out a small black book from his trouser pocket. Unwinding the twine that kept it closed, he thumbed through the pages, his gaze scanning up and down them.
"Oh," he said, "we have a problem."
"We do?"
"It appears that I have made the last two hot beverages, Lewis. I'm afraid I can't make you a third. That will upset the system greatly. You'll have to work back your hot beverage debt before I make you another."
A short walk into Sunhampton later, and I was in Paisley's store in town,
pacing around her shelves at a rate that would wear out the floor if I wasn't careful. The window on her shopfront, made from glass that constantly sparkled not through artifice but Paisley's care and attention, looked out onto Coiner's Way, the main thoroughfare of Sunhampton. Way across the street, opposite the store, was the Sunny Cafe. Next to it was a new cotton craft shop opened by Mo Henderson, who supplied Paisley with scarves to sell. On either side of Paisley's store was a cobbler's workshop run by Rosie Blue and a tailor's store owned by Mr. Fluitt, who was retiring soon. If the workshop at the Craftstead was my happy place, then Paisley's store was a close second. The workshop was like my main home, and her little shop was my coastal weekend getaway place. It was always warm, well lit, and best of all, I knew I could visit during opening hours and my best friend would be waiting with a hot chocolate and a smile, and no sign whatsoever of a hot beverage debt notebook. Right now, Paisley was sitting behind her counter, sketching out plans for a shop refit. We talked about me creating some artifice shelves for her, which would allow her to make the most out of her limited store space, while she was hoping to utilize the rear storage room as part of the main customer-facing store to double its size. "He's driving me insane," I said, walking a circuit around the four long wooden shelves in the middle of the store. "He has a little book where he keeps a tally of how many drinks we've made for each other." "Philip means well," said Paisley. "Sorry, he wants to be called Phil now, doesn't he?" "I know he's not doing it to annoy me, but the rules, Paisley, endless rules. It's a damned artificer's workshop. I don't know why Cooper rented workshop space to him. It's not like we need the money. Crafters look after fellow crafters. Phil needed a space where he could make his boats, and he couldn't afford anywhere else. Cooper's just helping him get started," said Paisley. "I know, I ought to be more patient." "You're allowed to get annoyed, Lewis, and you're doing the right thing by getting it out here in my store, to me, rather than losing it with Phil. Maybe you ought to talk to him." "What do you mean?" I said. "Talk to him. Tell him exactly what he's doing that bothers you, and ask him to stop it." I paused my pacing. "Speak to him about why he's annoying me." "Sure." Resuming my pacing, I said, "You're crazy. That'll never work. If people did that, then problems would get worked out easily." "Fine, but in the meantime, can you stop walking around? You're making me tired just watching you, and you're kicking up dust." "Sorry," I said. I grabbed a broom from where it was leaning next to the counter and quickly swept the floor, before putting the broom back in its place. Then I walked around the counter and sat on the stool next to Paisley, elbow to elbow. "I guess it isn't just Phil. Things are changing. Janie's moving into the Craftstead too. I've heard that's what happens when you get married. It's great having her around. She really brightens up the place, you know. But Cooper's reorganising the yard to make room for a new alchemy workshop and storefront. The place is going to be hectic for the next few weeks, what with all the builders. I guess the saving grace is that he doesn't need to change the workshop. It's artificed, so the inside is bigger than the outside." "I sympathise, I really do. Nobody likes to change, except maybe if you're locked in a dungeon and the change is getting released, or if you're on fire and the change is a bucket of water. But think about it from Cooper's point of view." "What about it?" I said. "All the things he's had to get used to. He lived on his own in the Craftstead for decades, and then you came along, and suddenly he's got an apprentice sharing his house and his workshop. Then Chris came to live with him, and now Janie. If a stubborn old guy like Mr. Cooper can get used to it, then surely you can." I'd never really thought about it from that point of view. I guess that for me, all the changes in my life had been good. I'd swapped my stepfather for Master Cooper, travelling around Easterly alone for living in the Craftstead. No ambition, no direction for a career in artificery. It's easy to get used to change when all the changes in your life are positive ones. What about Cooper, though? He'd given up living by and working for himself to having to teach me artificery while sharing his home with me. He'd even reluctantly conformed to the chore schedule that I had drafted. I guessed I had never really stopped to appreciate just how much Cooper's life had altered in the past couple of years. "I suppose I can be a little more patient with everything," I said. "With Phil, too?" I nodded. "And with Phil." The afternoon was what some people might call dreary, but I liked it. The worse the weather was outside, the cozier it felt inside. I enjoyed being in the warm workshop while the wind howled like a wolfhound demanding its dinner. I liked how the rain pattered against the window panes, every gentle tap on the glass a reminder that I was indoors in my favourite place, working at my bench under the glow of gentle lamplight. It was a reminder that I was warm and dry and had no obligations ahead of me but to spend a few hours crafting. Phil had taken a seat at a workbench on the opposite end of the workshop to me. In front of him was the keel of a galleon he was making, with no sign yet of masts or rigging. It was intricate work, and often involved him leaning over in an awful posture while wearing a magnifying glass over one eye. "Cup of coffee," I said, standing up and heading to our refreshment counter in the corner. "Oh, thank you. 2 sugars, please." I made Phil and myself a coffee, then I stood by his bench until I saw him take out his little black book and make a tally mark next to my name. With hot beverage parity almost restored, and happy that I had at least made an effort to get along with him, I settled back behind my workbench. Phil turned around on his stool and looked in my direction. "What are you working on?" We had instigated, on Phil's insistence, a no-talking except when we were both having a break rule in the workshop, so it was a surprise to hear him ask me a question. I wondered if he was also making an effort to compromise. "Telepathic notebooks," I said. "Spruce Wilkinson is trying something at the Sunny Cafe. Some of his older customers can't get around as easily as they used to, so he asked if there are any artificeric solutions that will help them order from the cafe easier. They can place their food orders at home, and he'll receive them in the cafe. When they're ready, he'll get his delivery boy to take the food over to them."
"And telepathy is the solution?"
"It's not mind-reading telepathy like a psych mage," I said. "A telepathic notebook is just the name for it, although we do use myodes from a mind-reading scroll." He tapped the workbench with his index finger, his eyes deep in thought.
"It's complicated work, isn't it, artificery? I always imagined, well, I don't know, I just didn't expect it to be so intricate. When you wear those goggles of yours, it reminds me of when I have to work on my rigging with a needle and twine."
"I guess so.
Well, anyway, my galleon won't build itself. I'll leave you to get on with it."
Turning around toward his own workbench, Phil soon had his magnifying lens set against his right eye and was lost in his work, tweezers in hand, his back bent in that same poor posture that I was sure would cause him problems later in life. I turned back to my own work. "Okay," I thought, eyeing the materials on the workbench. "Let's see about these notebooks." There were 3 myotypes in play when creating a telepathic notebook. Working with 3 myodes in one item was something I had learned to do very recently after leveling my enchantment skill tree from simple to intermediate. As ever with improving my abilities or leveling new ones, the novelty hadn't worn off yet. "Right then," I said aloud. "First I need to disenchant the telepathy scroll." Phil turned around on his stool and mimed pulling a zip across his lips. Resisting the urge to roll my eyes, I nodded in acknowledgement. In my time in the craftstead, I had often worked alone, and I had gotten used to saying my thoughts out loud, almost as if by doing so I was writing them down in a crafting notebook. Now, keeping my thoughts securely in my head, I got to work. My first step was to use my disenchant ability on the scroll of telepathy, which had the effect of removing the mana from the scroll and converting it to myodes, ready for artificeric use. Myode salvaged, telepathy. Percentage salvaged, 68%. "Huh, not a bad percentage at all." Phil snapped around quicker than a cobra and mimed the zip across his lips again. "Sorry, Phil."
"Quiet time is quality time," he said. Then he added, "That's another of my own sayings."
"They ought to print it on tea towels." Phil took my reply in the complete opposite way to how I meant it and smiled.
"Thank you, Lewis."
Returning my focus to my work, I placed the telepathy myodes in a myode pool container and set it next to the other 2 myode pool containers I had procured earlier. There, within the little glass containers, should be everything I needed to create the telepathic notebooks. 3 myode types for 3 different artificeric effects. Myode type, telepathy. Effect, the ability to transfer information from point A to point B without physical exertion. Myode type, amplifier. Effect, increases the range of an artificeric effect. Myode type, extender. Effect, extends the usage life of an item. Artificery could be an art or a science, depending on who you asked. There was technique and precision involved in every step, but a lot of creativity too. The end result often owed blessings to the gods of random chance. You might intend to create a self-cleaning oven, but what you may get instead is one that adds a subtle soap fragrance to anything to put in it. Artificery can be finicky that way. The higher your artificery skill, the more chance you had of your outcome being exactly what you wanted. Me, well, I had risen in ranks from apprentice to novice, then novice to initiate, and I wasn't even 18 years old yet. That was good going. Even so, I was way, way off being in complete control of my artificery. Let's see if I can get this right the first time, I thought. Using my enchant ability, I combined the three Myo types with the two blank notebooks. A buzzing sound came from the token bracelet on my wrist, and I felt all the abilities under my intermediate enchant skill tree get locked out for use. Soon, token text drifted into the air in front of me. Artificery complete. Minor notebook of mind reading. A notebook that can read the minds of those around it. This didn't sound right. I wanted the two notebooks to have a telepathic link with each other, not to be able to read minds. I picked up one of the notebooks. While before it had been a simple pad filled with blank sheets, the kind that you might find dozens of in any general store, the notebooks had a different quality to them now, a sort of otherness, a sense of power within their depths in the same way a person could pick up a mage's spell scroll and know that it wasn't just a sheet of paper. Just then, words began to write themselves onto the blank sheet of the notebook I was holding. I really ought to be more patient with Lewis. This is his workshop, after all. He's going to think I'm an ass, but I've always found it hard to concentrate ever since I was a boy. The slightest sound just ruins my focus. Wow. I eyed Phil, then the notebook. Was I really seeing what I thought I was? I supposed it wasn't too surprising that the notebook could read minds, given the myodes that I had used. Even so, this was a strong effect. Really, this was almost journeyman-level artificery, and only the gods of random chance had put it in the hands of an initiate. Then again, the notebooks were rated minor. That meant there would be some pretty strong drawbacks to their effects. I just had to figure out what they were. Immediately after I had the thought, the page with Phil's thoughts disintegrated into ash, falling in a heap on the workbench. Eyeing the sooty mess, it was clear now what the notebook's limitation was. Each page could hold only a single thought and would disintegrate after less than 30 seconds. What's more, the notebook only had 50 pages. The workshop door opened. When nobody entered, I knew from experience to look down towards the floor. Sure enough, Betsy, one of our wolfhounds, had nudged the door open with her nose and walked in. "Hey, Betsy," I said, "who's a good girl?" Phil spun around. He lifted his hand towards his lips and then stopped, as if something had occurred to him, or he had thought better of it. This made me appreciate what I had seen in the notebook. Phil was trying to be patient with me just as I was with him, and both of us were struggling. Though this made me feel better. It also made me feel guilty, as if I had pressed my ear against a keyhole and listened to a conversation that had nothing to do with me. "Listen, Phil," I said, "you're paying Cooper to be here, so this is your workspace just as much as it is mine. I guess I've just gotten used to being here alone, that's all. I like to talk as I work, it helps me think, but some people need silence to concentrate, so I'll make an effort to be quieter, okay?" He seemed taken aback. "Oh, okay. How about I make us a coffee?" "But I still have one more drink to make for my hot beverage debt." "Well, perhaps we both need to make compromises, Lewis." Chapter 2. I gathered up both mind-reading notebooks and put them in my crafter's satchel before heading toward the workshop door. Thinking twice, I turned on my heel and went over to the pantry in the corner where I opened the biscuit jar that Phil, Cooper and I shared. Cooper must have been the last person to raid it, because the glass was smeared with oil and the lid was screwed on so tightly that I had to grunt and really put force into loosening it. When the lid finally gave up its grip, I took out 6 chocolate chip biscuits for my journey. Phil watched me, his gaze following my hand from the jar to my pocket and back again. "Are you sure you have enough?" he said. "Don't worry, I'll fill the jar back up. I learned my lesson with the water and the kettle." "But 6 cookies, Lewis. Really?" 5 isn't enough, and 7 is too many. What kind do you want next time? Chocolate chip again, or ginger nuts?" Phil smiled. "How about you choose? I picked chocolate chip after all. It can be your choice this time." "No problem. If Cooper asks, I'm going to be out for the rest of the day." "See you, Lewis." Heading out of the crafted and down the sloping hill towards Sunhampton, it wasn't long before my biscuit supply was gone. Just as I had planned, 6 biscuits had been the exact amount needed to see me through the trip, and as I chewed my last mouthful, I was standing at the beginning of Coiner's Way, where the rain was lashing down. The afternoon was already ending, and with the seasons perched between autumn and winter, the sky above the mercantile street was already darkening. That, coupled with a full day of rain, meant that the street was emptier than usual, with only a few people braving it. Bill Pumice, whose wagon I had once fixed when I was an apprentice, hurried past with his coat fastened up so the collar covered his neck and his mouth. A nearby couple, Emma Delaney the blacksmith and her new girlfriend Maud, walked hand in hand, each armed with their own umbrella and trying to avoid knocking them against each other as they skirted around the puddles that were forming on the cobbled streets. Gutters filled up to the brim. Drainpipes leaked and spat. Boots and galoshes splashed through puddles. And from all around Coiner's Way came the pitter-patter of rain on glass. It was certainly the wrong day for a trip into town. A stranger passing by might take one look at my coat and scoff. "The lad's a fool. Look at his coat, so thin and tatty, he'll get soaked through." But that was okay, because I was an artificer and we have ways of dealing with the weather. A stare that lingered on my coat for more than just a few seconds would reveal the truth. Raindrops bounced off my artificed garment like a sword glancing off a well-positioned shield, and no matter how many times the raindrops tried to breach my defences, they were repelled. Only my hair got wet, and I soon felt it plastered down against my head, sending little raindrops scurrying underneath my shirt collar and onto my back. I could have put my hood up, of course, but I've always enjoyed the feeling of my hair and face getting soaked in the rain. I'm not sure why. There's just something refreshing about it, something that gives me a sense of clarity. Chris or Paisley would have called me mad.
"Afternoon, Initiate Cooper," said Lee Hunter.
He was standing in the doorway of his hunting shop, holding a cup of coffee in his right hand. He raised it at me in greeting.
"Hey, Lee, don't suppose you need a crossbow? Some bolts?"
"Sorry," I said.
"It's bloody rain. Nobody thinks about hunting when it's like this. Fishing, that's another story. Fish love a bit of rain, Lewis. Do you know why?"
"They think the raindrops are, I don't know, worms falling into the water."
Lee laughed, but in a good-natured way.
"It's because there are more flies around the water surface when it rains. The fish love it. It's like a buffet for them. You know who doesn't like the rain?"
"People?"
"People, yes. But more importantly to me, things that live in the woods. They tend to shelter when it's wet."
He let out a long sigh.
"Kelly Flanders' tackle shop will be making a mint on a day like today.
Hopefully things will pick up.
Cross your fingers, toes, and your pecker."
Sure, I'll try."
"I know a man who could do that, you know. He had to stop eventually. He had problems. Anyway, take care, Lewis."
"Bye, Lee," I said, hurrying on through the empty street. I shared some of Lee Hunter's dismay at the lack of footfall here today. I had never really paid attention to how busy Coiner's Way was on any particular day, not until Paisley opened her store. Now I found myself always gauging how many people were around and crossing my fingers that the weather would be sunny, or if the sun was being miserly, that it would at least be dry. I always hoped that tourists would visit our town and in turn spend a few coins in Paisley's store. Today, however, wasn't one of those days. The shop bell made a tring sound as I entered. At the counter, Chris and Paisley both looked up in unison and gave me a smile and a wave. Since securing a job as a town crier in a place called Perrenty, Chris no longer had to commute far away to Full Striding, and instead could walk to work and back via Hoggarty Pass, a nice country path that cut through the wild grass fields east of Sunhampton. This meant that he could spend much more time with Paisley and me here in town. This invariably involved him whiling away an hour or three in her store. Paisley glared at me.
"I thought I told you I didn't want you cold calling in my store," she nudged Chris. "This guy has been pestering me all week, Chris, trying to get me to buy his tat. He reckons it's artificed, but it all looks like junk to me."
"He does look suspicious, Pays," said Chris. "We should get the guards."
I laughed. "Maybe it's usually junk, but not today."
"We're just thinking of getting food at the King's Head. Fancy joining us?"
I had never to date rejected an offer to get a tasty snack at the King's Head. It was my favourite tavern. But I paused before accepting.
"Were you planning a Chris and Paisley the couple type of meal, or a Chris and Paisley plus guests kind?"
"The latter," said Paisley, "and count me in."
"All right, I'll just check the stock room and then I'll lock up."
Paisley checked every room in her store twice and then locked the front door. Eyeing her darkened storefront, she told it, "Night store, sleep tight."
"It's not night yet," I said. "But I won't be back until tomorrow, will I?" said Paisley, giving the
sample complete. Ready to continue?